And welcome back to the second half of Earth First Radio. I'm Uncle Dennis, and there's more important information coming up, so please keep that pencil and recycled paper handy. And let's get right on into our commentary, which we present every week. This commentary was published Monday, May 22nd in the Toronto Globe and Mail. It's entitled, Cry the Beloved Planet. The Earth as we know it has less than 30 years to survive if we continue our destructive course. And our commentary tonight was written by Maurice Strong. Where on earth are we going? It is not merely a title of my book, but the fundamental question that confronts the human community as we begin this new millennium. The short answer to this is that it is up to us, for human numbers and the scale and intensity of human activities have reached the point at which we are impinging upon the environmental and life support systems on which life on Earth as we know it depends. We literally are the principal architects of our future. What we do or fail to do will determine the fate of Earth as a hospitable home for the human species. Other forms of life will, of course, be affected, and indeed many species are already becoming extinct at unprecedented rates. But humans are now the dominant species and in many ways the most vulnerable to the risks that have been created by the same processes that have produced wealth and prosperity beyond the dreams of past generations. What a paradox it is that our success as a species threatens our future. In the course of human experience, there are many instances in which great civilizations became victims of mismanagement of their own environment and natural resources. Tragic as these events were for those involved, life went on and new civilizations emerged, culminating in the technological civilization in which we now live. The difference is that this civilization is global in scale, and our failure to manage it effectively and responsibly will have consequences for all humanity. Dire predictions are never popular, but they are not always wrong. When your doctor gives you an unwelcome diagnosis that your life is at risk, you are surely unwise to ignore it. The preponderance of scientific opinion, as most recently displayed in the report of the National Academy of Sciences of the United States, provides us with an informed and well-documented diagnosis of the dangers facing Earth and the risk that those pose to human beings' life and well-being. Political leaders, businessmen, and individuals make decisions every day based on the best evidence available at the time. Surely then it would be folly to wait for that certainty that only a post-mortem could provide. This is especially true when most of the treasures we need to take to avert those risks and measure and ensure a more sustainable and secure future would be good for us in any event, economically as well as environmentally. In the book, I present a fictional scenario for the end of the year 2030, which postulates a world that has degenerated into chaos, conflict, and societal breakdown of a colossal scale. This is not a prediction. It is simply an attempt to portray the kind of world that would result from our continuing, quote, business-as-usual, unquote, attitude toward the actions and policies through which we are shaping our future. The book envisages a world in which the extremes of weather and natural disasters have taken more lives and caused more damage than both world wars of the 20th century. The structures of government and law and order have broken down. People are fending for themselves, and those on whom they once relied for security are now controlling and exploiting them. Services and infrastructures are dysfunctional and disease is rampant. Food, water, and essential materials are in short supply, and conflicts over them are intense and violent. Population has declined precipitously with the spread of disease, starvation, and conflict. Troubled people are on the move in vast numbers, resorting to every possible means of entering America, Europe, and other countries thought to offer refuge. There has been a resurgence of religious extremism and religious conflict. People have turned away from the reasoned voice of science. At the political level, the nation-state system has broken down, and many have broken up. The United Nations had not been able to meet, as no agreement could be reached on what new self-declared nations should be recognized as members. It may be fiction, but it is not far-fetched. I am convinced that it is the kind of world we will have in or around the year 2030 if we continue on our present course. And it need not be. We now have the knowledge, the understanding, and the tools with which to make the kind of change of course called for by business leaders at the Earth Summit held in Rio de Janeiro in June of 1992. Unfortunately, despite the progress made on many fronts since the Earth Summit, we are still on a pathway to the kind of world that makes such doomsday scenarios real possibilities. What must we do? The answer? To change. To change our policies, priorities, behaviors, and the values that motivate us, the first thing to do is to change the system of incentives and penalties by which governments motivate the economic behavior of corporations and individuals to encourage practices that are more environmentally and socially friendly. A recent study of the Earth Council estimates that in four sectors alone, water, energy, transport, and agriculture, more than $700 billion a year is spent on subsidizing practices that are environmentally and socially damaging and economically costly. Whatever purpose such subsidies had originally intended to serve, they have become entrenched in the system long after they were needed. If we make such a change, market forces would become an ally, and businesses would be motivated to concentrate on products and services that are environmentally sound and socially beneficial. In the days since our first blush of environmental concern, we have lost our innocence. We now know a great deal about the damage we are doing and how to remedy it. Technology has given us an impressive array of new tools with which to pursue sound and sustainable production and consumption patterns. Of course, there is much more we can always learn, but overall, implementation is no longer a problem. The problem is one of motivation. Opinion surveys today indicate that the public does not give the highest priority to the environment, even though they show a strong and continued commitment from the majority of people to the need to protect and improve the environment. In more industrialized countries, people have become preoccupied more and more with their own self-interests. The environmental stress is on a global environment. As a result of climatic change, accelerating destruction of biological resources and damage to the Earth's other vital life support systems. Meanwhile, developing countries are experiencing to a greater extent the same kind of air and water pollution and deterioration of natural resources that first made the environment an issue in the more mature industrialized countries. Present preoccupations with their immediate self-interest, people everywhere are motivated at the deepest level by their moral, ethical, and spiritual values. As we now know, that responsibility for the future of life on Earth rests with us. This has become one of the greatest challenges to our value system. No nation of the Earth can go it alone in ensuring a sustainable and promising future. It requires unprecedented levels of cooperation, and to provide the foundations for this cooperation, we must develop a set of moral and ethical principles and spiritual values that people of all religions, philosophical, ideological, and political persuasions, and ethnic origins can embrace. It is with this realization that I propose to the world leaders gathered at Rio that they adopt an Earth Charter, a Magna Carta for the Earth, articulating a basic set of moral and ethical principles and spiritual values to guide the conduct of nations of people toward the Earth and each other. Governments were not ready for it, and it was one of my greatest disappointments that they did not agree to it at Rio. Following Rio, I joined with Mikhail Gorbachev and other leaders from around the world to develop the People's Earth Charter, incorporating the contributions of thousands of people. It will be launched formally at a ceremony at the Peace Place in The Hague, Netherlands, sometime in June, I guess it took place, and people everywhere will be invited to use it as a basis for examining their own moral, ethical, and spiritual values, inculcating them in the behavior of their communities, institutions, and businesses. Plans call for presentation of the Earth Charter to the United Nations at a special session of the General Assembly to be held in 2002 on the 10th anniversary of the Earth Summit and the 30th anniversary of the Stockholm Conference, which first put these issues on the world agenda. For implementation will surely follow motivation, thus it is that I am concentrating my time and energies at this time of my life on trying to improve the motivation that I am convinced is the key to a more secure, sustainable, and promising future that I still believe is achievable. Our commentary today was written by Maurice Strong. Maurice Strong is a former senior advisor to the UN Secretary General Kofi Annan and to the President of the World Bank. His book, Where on Earth Are We Going?, was published by Knopf. I want to read you the 16 principles of the Earth Charter. Respect for Earth and all life. Care for the community of life in all its diversity. Strive to build free, just, participatory, sustainable, and peaceful societies. Secure Earth's abundance and beauty for present and future generations. Protect and restore the integrity of Earth's ecological systems with special concern for biological diversity and natural processes that sustain and renew life. Prevent harm to the environment as the best method of ecological protection, and when knowledge is limited, take the path of caution. Treat all living things with compassion and protect them from wanton destruction. adopt patterns of consumption, production, and reproduction that respect and safeguard Earth's regenerative capacities, human rights, and community well-being. Ensure that economic activities support and promote human development in an equitable and sustainable manner. Eradicate poverty as an ethical, social, economic, and ecological imperative. Honor and defend the right of all persons without discrimination to an environment supportive of their dignity, bodily health, and spiritual well-being. Advance worldwide the cooperative study of ecological systems, the dissemination and application of knowledge and development, adoption and transfer of clean technologies. Establish access to information, inclusive participation in decision-making, and transparency, truthfulness, and accountability in governance. Affirm and promote gender equality as a prerequisite to sustainable development. Make the knowledge, values, and skills needed to build just and sustainable communities an integral part of the formal education and lifelong learning for all. And create a culture of peace and cooperation. And these are principles of an Earth Charter, were taken from the book Where on Earth Are We Going? Written by Maurice Strong and, as I said, published by Knopf. And that's our commentary for today. Let's get back into activist news. From Estacada, Oregon, an article for the Associated Press written by Tara Burghardt, authorities disperse protesters who are trying to halt logging. This written on July 7th. The U.S. Forest Service drove anti-logging protesters from roadblocks on the Mount Hood National Forest last Friday, breaking up a year-long demonstration that had blocked harvest of a timber sale. Actually, I believe that was a four-year-long demonstration. We have opened the roads for the timber sale, said Gary Larson, forest supervisor. No arrests or injuries were reported. I believe that actually two arrests were made. But protesters complained authorities were heavy-handed. Though roadblocks were cleared, some protesters continued to occupy nearby trees. Protesters said those remaining rigged nooses around their necks to make it harder to get them down. Activists argue that logging in the Eagle Creek watershed threatens a drainage that provides water to almost 200,000 people in the Portland area, could harm rare plants and animals, and destroy centuries-old trees. Environmentalists had suspended aerial pods made of cargo nets above the gates of two U.S. Forest Service roads that branch out into a Y leading to the timber sale. They had also constructed tree platforms as support structures near the two pods, one at each entrance. Larson said Forest Service law enforcement agents, police, and other federal officials arrived about 4:30 in the morning to order protesters out of the area. About a dozen left voluntarily, he said, but four initially remained, one in each of the pods in the tree platforms. Authorities later removed one woman from a pod by 10:30 in the morning using a utility cherry picker, while another woman in a nearby tree platform came down voluntarily, Larson said. The media was being held back from the other site while the utility equipment was sent to remove the final pair of protesters. Environmentalists said the surprise raid was conducted with weapons drawn by federal agents and police wearing camouflage gear, including some on horseback. They came rushing in at 4:30 in the morning in full military gear, said one protester who identified herself only as Leaf. They came in out of the woods. She said there were folks on horseback. We were pinned to the ground. They followed us around all through the woods like we were criminals. Larson denied the police drew weapons or wore special equipment or clothing, but another protester, Brian Schultz, said authorities were careless about the way they freed ropes tied from the pods to the gates of the Forest Service roads. Schultz said police and federal agents completely and blatantly disregarded the life of the woman up there in one of the pods suspended over the access road. Leaf said remaining protesters had fastened nooses attached to supporting ropes on the pods suspended over the roads so that if the supporting ropes were cut, the protesters would be hanged. We're really hoping they're not going to hurt anyone. The way the structures were built, if they try to take them down, they will collapse and definitely hurt the people in them, according to Photonaut. And momentum builds for the Kent Creek occupation to save Indian burial grounds. Activists are decrying planned county destruction of wetlands. A coalition of environmentalists, farmers, Native American activists, and students have gathered near Rockford, Illinois, to prevent Winnebago County bulldozers from plowing the lands of 30-year resident Tom Ditzler for a proposed four-lane highway project. Ditzler is a blind U.S. military veteran who has vigorously opposed the seizure. He knows his land by heart from the days when he once could see it and wants to pass it on to his surviving daughter. In addition, Miles Goddard, an anthropologist-archaeologist from DuPage College, who has excavated artifacts from the site, discovered that these vital wetlands house Native American burial mounds. Participants in the mobilization vow to engage in civil disobedience in order to stop the roadworking crews who chose not to show up last Thursday. Coalition members have established a base camp on Ditzler's property to assist in preventing the onset of the planned demolition. County plans call for using $17 million in taxpayer funds to raise the land with 70 feet of gravel, straighten Kent Creek, and cut down a portion of a hardwood forest which includes Native American trail trees and ancient oaks, one of which is hundreds of years old. Winnebago County is seizing the property, the privately held wetlands, for the Springfield-Harrison extension under the quick take policy that permits the government to seize private property, begin construction, and settle up with the property owner later. To undercut opposition, county officials have threatened lawsuits against critics of the project, including Goddard and local organizer Dean Eckberg, who has helped rally public support to preserve the mounds and wetlands. Groups that have rallied around to fight to preserve the wetlands include Winnebago County Concerned Citizens, Sustained Communications, Midwest Soaring, Anawan, the Ho-Chunk Nation, the Iowa Tribe of Oklahoma, the Illinois Conservation Voters, Red Gate Earth First, the Chicago Direct Action Network. Supporters have traveled from as far away as Texas to support the campaign to prevent the land seizure. They welcome any kind of support and donations that are possible. What do they need? They need lawyers, tree sitters, carpenters, builders, two-way radios, climbing gear, bicycles, bug spray with no DEET, if possible, mosquito netting, cargo netting, natural first aid products, vegan food, cooking oil, rice, beans, veggies, fruit, energy bars, whatever the hell you got, kryptonite, bike locks, lock boxes, car batteries, wood for construction and obstruction, nails, concrete, brick hammers, coolers, ladders, pallets, cordless drills, drywall screws of assorted length, lag bolts of 3 to 3.5 inches, banners, posters, signs, be creative, shovels, flashlights, headlamps, firewood, pirate transmitter, camouflage, camping and hunting wear, cell phones, to borrow, they'll give them back if they can, toilet paper, instruments, pans, pots, and utensils, and please, no more dogs. When have I ever heard that? If you are able to provide any of the following items, please contact Jesse Crow. His number, 815-332-7044. That's Jesse Crow, 815-332-7044. Or you can send email to season5@inwave.com. That's season5@inwave.com. Continuing their four-year struggle to protect over 500 acres of inventoried roadless area, activists with the Cascadia Forest Alliance took their message to U.S. Regional Forester Harv Forgren's office in downtown Portland recently. Activists remain undaunted and committed in their vigil to see the Eagle Creek timber sales canceled once and for all. At a 6 p.m. rally to protest the raid on the peaceful Eagle Creek road blockade, Trey, an activist with the Cascadia Forest Alliance, scaled the walls of the Region 6 headquarters and refused to come down until the sales were canceled. Well, bully for you, Trey. Trey remains precariously perched on the ledge of the third story of the federal building. What we witnessed yesterday is a perfect example of what extreme measures the Forest Service will take to force an unacceptable timber sale on the unwilling public, said Trey. I'm not coming down until this timber sale is canceled. And I'm sorry that was out of order, but it was supposed to follow the other one. But anyway, you got to hear it anyway. Yuba Nation members face charges. Misdemeanor criminal conspiracy charges were filed last Friday against two members of Yuba Nation, who last month disrupted Sierra Pacific Industries' logging operations. District Attorney Michael Ferguson filed misdemeanor charges ranging from trespassing to resisting arrest to conspiracy against five members of the Loose-Knit Environmental Activist Group. Four of those charges are scheduled to be arraigned last Monday in Nevada County Superior Court. Ferguson also said he would seek to make the protesters repay money lost by a logging contractor, Robinson Enterprises Incorporated, when Yuba Nation disrupted timber harvest activities. And Ferguson will ask that protesters be ordered to compensate the Nevada County Sheriff's Department for overtime paid to deputies who responded to the incident. I'm going to seek restitution, Ferguson said. The bottom line is, a legal business was interfered with because of illegal acts and suffered damage. Ferguson couldn't say Friday exactly how much he would seek in restitution. But officials from Robinson Enterprises weren't available for comment either, but their Nevada City-based business lost $18,000 in gross revenue on June 6th when Yuba Nation protesters blocked a logging road with a tripod made of logs. That protest occurred on Tahoe National Forest land. Yuba Nation member Brian Keith. Vincent was sitting on a tripod platform about 30 feet off the ground, supplied with food and water when authorities arrived. Vincent agreed to come down after negotiating with law enforcement officials and was ticketed by the Forest Service. Ferguson is seeking conspiracy charges against Vincent and Heidi Suzanne Starr based on an opinion page column that appeared on April 22nd in the Union. The column, which included the court filings, said that thanks to Sierra Pacific Industries, nonviolent direct action is now thriving in Nevada County, and warned that, quote, Yuba Nation is willing and ready to lay our bodies on the line to protect this region's rich biological legacy. Ferguson said criminal conspiracy occurs when two or more people agree to commit a crime and one or more overt acts are taken towards the commission of that crime. Conspiracy charges carry penalties of up to a year in county jail and fines of up to $10,000. Said Vincent, these charges will not have any chilling effect on my commitment to exposing Sierra Pacific Industries' crimes against nature. Said Vincent, 38, a longtime activist. He said he's been arrested about 10 times for civil disobedience. Quote, if I am incarcerated, I vow the day I get out, I will be right back on Sierra Pacific Industries' doorstep. All right. And also from Nevada City. 25 Nevada County businesses urged the Board of Supervisors today to convey community concerns about Sierra Pacific Industries' logging practices to Governor Gray Davis. In a letter to the board, the businesses said that the timber company's accelerated clear-cutting and industrial logging near the Yuba River has adversely impacted the environment and the local economy, and asked the board to take action similar to that of the Calaveras County Board of Supervisors. In June, Calaveras officials asked the governor to halt the Sierra Pacific Industry logging operation near Big Tree State Park and institute immediate reforms in logging practices. Nevada County businesses said they were troubled by logging along the middle fork of the Yuba River and a new proposed SPI project, the Fall Creek Timber Harvest Plan, near the South Yuba. And unfortunately, that's all the time I have for news. If you'd like to get news or announcements from your bioregion to Earth First Radio, send us email at cruzief@cruzio.com. That's cruzief@cruzio.com. Or you can send letters to Earth First Radio. We're at P.O. Box 344, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. Once again, that's Earth First Radio, P.O. Box 344, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. Be sure to send those announcements at least 3 weeks in advance. If you'd like more in-depth news and information about the Earth First movement, please subscribe to the Earth First Journal. Their address is P.O. Box 1415, Eugene, Oregon, 97440. Once again, the Earth First Journal, P.O. Box 1415, Eugene, Oregon, 97440. You can listen to Earth First Radio on your computer. We're at www.microradio.net/FRSC. That's www.microradio.net/FRSC. Or you can go to www.radioforall.net. That's www.radio4all.net. You'll need a sound card in your computer, but the software you need to play these files is free on those websites. Earth First Radio is carried on a growing number of free speech and non-commercial radio stations. Please ask your local station to rebroadcast Earth First Radio. Earth First Radio is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. Our theme music was written and performed by Daryl Cherney off the CD Keep It Wild. I'm Uncle Dennis. Thank you for listening to Earth First Radio. And now we're going to listen to some music off of Dana Lyons. This one's called Cows with Guns.
Fat and docile, big and dumb. They look so stupid, they aren't much fun. Cows aren't fun. They eat to grow, grow to die, die to be ate at the hamburger fry. Cows well done. Nobody thunk it, nobody knew. No one imagined the great cow guru. Cows are one. He hid in the forest, read books with great zeal. He loved Che Guevara, a revolutionary veal. Cows say tongue. He spoke about justice, but nobody stirred. He felt like an outcast, alone in the herd. like outlaw drums. He moved, we must fight, escape or we'll die. Cows gathered around, cause the stakes were so high. Bad cow pun. But then he was captured, stuffed into a crate, loaded onto a truck where he rode to his fate. Cows are bummed. He was a scrawny calf who looked rather woozy. No one expected he was packing an Uzi. Cows with guns. They came with a needle to stick in his thigh. He kicked for the groin. He pissed in their eye. Cow well hung. Knocked over a tractor and ran for the door. 6 gallons of gas flowed out on the floor. Run, cows, run. He picked up a bullhorn and jumped up on the hay. We are free-roving bovines. We run free today.
We will fight for bovine freedom and hold our large heads high. We will run free with the buffalo or die. Cows with guns.
Crashed the gate in a great stampede, tipped over milk truck, torched all the feed. Cows have fun. 60 police cars were piled in a heap, covered in cow pies, covered up deep. Much cow dung. Black smoke rising, darkening in the day, 12 burning McDonald's. Have it your way.
We will fight for bovine freedom and hold our large heads high. We will run free with the buffalo or die.
Cows with guns. The president said, enough is enough. These uppity cattle, it's time to get tough. Cow dung flung. The newspapers gloated, folks sighed with relief. Tomorrow at noon, they would all be ground beef. Cows on buns. The cows were surrounded, they waited and prayed. They mooed their last moos, they chewed their last hay. Cows outgunned. The order was given to turn cows to whoppers, enforced by the might of 10,000 coppers. But on the horizon, surrounding the shoppers, came the deafening roar of chickens in choppers.
We will fight for bovine freedom.